This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The story of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy has been told many times by many people. Among those who told it first was the late Walter Cronkite. He anchored the CBS News coverage during the first hours after bullets hit the president in Dallas on November 22nd, 50 years ago today. A decade ago, Walter Cronkite put together a story about that fateful day for NPR. He combined his recollections with several remarkable recordings from the day of the assassination, recordings that few had heard before. Today, we rebroadcast Cronkite's reminiscences.
The government of the United States was at ease that afternoon, but unusually scattered. Congress was in session, but the president and vice president had been in Texas for 2 days. With the president away and Thanksgiving a week away, Washington seemed a vacant, almost open town. Even more unusual, 6 members of the president's cabinet, including Secretary of State Dean Rusk, were en route to Tokyo for talks with the Japanese. They had left Washington Wednesday for California, then rendezvoused with Presidential Press Secretary Pierre Salinger and senior Kennedy advisor McGeorge Bundy for a Thursday layover in Honolulu. Salinger would join the party and go on to Japan. It was 7 a.m. Friday morning in Hawaii, or about noon in Washington, when aircraft 86972 lifted off from Hickam Field carrying 2/3 of the Kennedy cabinet out across the Pacific. They'd been flying for an hour and a half before H hour in Dallas.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
The plane was nearly 900 miles west of Honolulu, bearing south from Midway, but not yet halfway to Wake Island, where it was to refuel. 4 minutes later, UPI moved Merriman Smith's first bulletin. UPI teletypes around the world started ticking out the news. One of them was on the communications deck of aircraft 972, where the radio officer blinked in disbelief at what he read. Another was at CBS News in New York, where my colleague Ed Bliss shouted the news across the room. I leaped from my desk to get on the air. But the cameras were not yet in place for the evening news, so I rushed into an adjoining radio booth. CBS was 10 minutes into its daily drama as the world turns when a CBS News bulletin slide appeared on the screen and a different drama took over the air.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting. Repeating.
In that plane over the Pacific, where the passenger cabin had neither radio nor television, protocol required that the radio operator take the UPI bulletin first to the ranking cabinet member, Dean Rusk. He told the cabinet that the president had been shot and that it could be fatal. Salinger insisted that the plane turn back to Honolulu immediately, but Rusk hesitated. He wanted confirmed facts, not press reports.
This is Situation Room. I read you. Go ahead.
You're listening to the original ground-to-air radio traffic just moments after the news first reached the plane over the Pacific, relayed from the UPI wire. These remarkable tapes provide a strikingly immediate document of men caught in an historic crisis. Salinger was among the first to get on the frequency.
Give me all available information on President, over.
All available information on President follows. He and Governor Connally of Texas have been hit in the car in which they were riding. We do not know how serious the situation is. We have no information. Mr. Bromley Smith is back here in the Situation Room now. We are getting our information over the tickers. Over.
That is affirmative, affirmative. Please keep us advised on here.
Rusk wanted official information direct from the White House, but the only information the White House had to give was what it was getting from the press. At 1:50 Eastern Time, the plane turned back to Honolulu.
That is affirmative, affirmative. This plane, on which Secretary of State, other cabinet ministers headed for Japan, turning around, returning to Honolulu, will arrive there approximately 2 hours. Over.
This is Wayside. Understand those departing Honolulu are turning around and will be back there in about 2 hours. Is that correct? Over.
That is affirmative.
With the White House so dispersed, there seemed reason to imagine a possibility even more unthinkable than assassination, a coup against the government of the United States. Salinger was being addressed from the Situation Room by his code name, Wayside. In the confusion of the moment, he didn't know whether to return to Dallas or Washington.
Roger. Do you have anything else, Wayside?
No, any other information, get a hold of as rapidly as possible.
All right. The Associated Press is coming out now with a bulletin to the effect that they believe the president was hit in the head. That just came in. Over.
At CBS in New York, our television cameras were up within 15 minutes. I sat at the news desk in shirt sleeves, surrounded by telephones, typewriters, a clutter of papers, and a lone apple that sat on the front edge of the desk. Our attention was focused so completely on Dallas it hardly seemed newsworthy that half the government was 4,000 miles out over the Pacific.
This is Walter Cronkite in our newsroom. There has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there, where their condition is as yet unknown.
Hold on the line there, Wayside. We have some more information coming up. I read from the AP bulletin, Kennedy apparently shot in head. He fell face down in back seat of his car. Blood was on his head. Mrs. Kennedy cried, oh no, and tried to hold up his head. Connally remained half-seated, slumped to the left. There was blood on his face and forehead. I have nothing further for you now. I will contact you if we get more.
Police, roger out.
The president was pronounced dead at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. But the news was not released. Conflicting rumors continued to circulate. Not even the Situation Room in the White House could tell plane 972 what was happening in Dallas.
Wayside, this is Situation Room. We have conflicting reports now, so we're not getting no confirmation. We will call you again. I have relayed your intentions and present position to the front office. Your office has the word. We will call you again when we get confirmation. Over.
This Wayside out.
By 2:30, there was a mounting consensus to the rumors. Eddie Barker was news director of CBS's Dallas affiliate and had some of the best police sources in the city. He was among the first to learn the true facts, and he worked closely with Bob Pierpoint and Dan Rather, who were covering the Kennedy visit for the network. I mark time. It's been 1 hour since that
electrifying flash came over the wires, that bullet shots had been heard to ring out in the Kennedy motorcade. There is the report in Dallas that the president is dead, but that has not been confirmed by any other source. And as late as 15 minutes ago, it was reported by aides outside in the corridor that he was still alive. The extent of his injuries is not known either. Regarding the probable assassin, a man 25 years old, we just have a report from our correspondent Dan Rather in Dallas that he has confirmed that President Kennedy is dead. There is still no official confirmation of this, however.
10 minutes later, press officer Malcolm Kilduff released the news, and it was official. It fell to me to make the announcement for CBS. My emotion was apparent as I fought to control my composure, locking it inside a clenched jaw.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital.
Those whose jobs often involve great emotional stress develop an amazing stoic power to defer emotion, a power that momentarily eluded me. None had it more than the men who had to give aircraft 972 the news. It was about 2:35 in the Capitol when the plane received a transmission from Crown, which was code name for the executive mansion.
Roger, sir. I have Crown on. Would you give him a call, sir?
Crown 972, go ahead.
died about 35 minutes ago. Do you have that? Over.
The president is dead. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. New subject. Front office desires plane return Washington with no stop Dallas. Over.
That copied. We got copied. All okay. And we return direct to Washington without stopping in Dallas. Roger, roger.
This is Situation Room out.
Attention now shifted to Vice President Lyndon Johnson. Back in New York at CBS, we had no information on his whereabouts and only sketchy information on his condition.
Vice President Johnson was in a following car and was apparently not hurt. He has left the hospital and has gone to an unknown destination where it is assumed he will shortly take the oath of office as the President of the United States.
The Vice President's destination, it turned out, was as unknown to us in New York as it was to the Situation Room in Washington. And the plane now flying east through five time zones over the Pacific didn't have the word either.
Situation Room, the Vice President is in the hospital building, Parkland Hospital in Dallas. He is not injured. I repeat, not injured. Over.
Copy.
Right.
With the President's death no longer in dispute and the Vice President safe, the sense of pandemonium began to ease and events took on a more predictable sense of form. We all knew what would be done now. Lyndon Johnson was already at Love Field in the presidential plane when Kilduff made his announcement. But Washington could not be informed because no scrambled line was available in Dallas. Over the Pacific, 972 was on its approach to Honolulu. There was nothing to do but let the process run its course.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. We continue now with the late Walter Cronkite's recollections about the day President Kennedy was killed. 2 hours after the shooting in Dallas, aircraft 26,000 was about to become Air Force One and take off for Washington. At the same time, a plane carrying Secretary of State Dean Rusk and other cabinet officers was nearing Honolulu.
Okay, we're coming up here.
This is Andrews. That is affirmed. 26,000 about getting ready to take off. He's on 1-3.
In the guarded protocols of the military, Air Force One became Air Force One only when the president stepped on board. Because there was no president for the moment, it was simply 26,000.
26,000, Andrews, are coming up.
26,000, check, please.
26,000, Andrews, loud and clear.
As 972 approached Honolulu, the presidential plane in Dallas was preparing for takeoff. It was 3:30 Eastern Time. The casket of the dead president lay in the rear of the plane. A search was on for the text of the oath and a judge to administer it. Secret Service agent Roy Kellerman in Dallas briefed the chief of the White House detail in Washington, Jerry Benn. You'll hear two code names. Volunteer refers to the vice president. Lace to Mrs. Kennedy.
Do you have any idea yet what Lace wants to do and what Volunteer wants to do on their arrival here?
No. I will call you back. Suggest we have a 2:15 flight in the Andrews.
All right, let me know what Volunteer wants to do when they land, if they want to come in to Crown by helicopter.
Roger, I'll call you again.
Okay.
Such conversations were beyond our reach in New York. We still, quite oddly it seems to me,
on this news desk have had no word from Dallas at all as to the location of Mr. Johnson, nor as to whether or not he has indeed taken the oath of office. It is assumed that he would have from a Dallas judge, a federal judge perhaps. We now learn that Vice President Johnson is expected to be sworn in as president aboard an airliner before flying back to the nation's capital.
I do solemnly swear.
Johnson took the oath in the privacy of the stateroom at 3:38 Eastern Time. 26,000 now became Air Force One, Angel in the code book of Secret Service aliases. It would be 90 minutes before we would receive word of his improvised inauguration. We just got the word that Lyndon B. Johnson
has been sworn in as the President of the United States. He was sworn in at 1:38 Central Standard Time. That was 2:38, and that's almost an hour and a half ago now, if this time is correct here. The oath was administered to him by U.S. District Judge Sarah T. Hughes.
Judge Hughes, three decades before her role in the assassination drama, had been the first woman appointed to the Texas court system. Her nomination by Governor Allred caused a mighty fight in the Texas Senate, a debate that I, as a young cub reporter, had helped cover.
Roger, Air Force One. Are you airborne at present?
Affirmative. Airborne at 2047.
10 minutes later, the plane was in the air. A strong tailwind pushed the airspeed close to Mach 1 as it flew east into the night. Aircraft 972 out of Honolulu followed 6 hours behind. Meanwhile, government was being improvised in the air. Arrangements had to be coordinated with Crown, code name for the Executive Mansion, for the arrival at Andrews. A call went out to Army Surgeon General Leonard Heaton.
Air Force One, this is Crown. General Heaton is at Walter Reed Hospital. You'll have to stand by just a moment, or else let me call you back when I get him on the line. It'll take about a minute to reach him.
Crown, Roger. Try to get General Heaton, and in the meantime, try to get the Deputy Surgeon General. We will talk to either one. This is very important.
Roger, I'll put an emergency on it. We'll get him as soon as possible.
This is Dr. Berkeley. I want to get in touch with General Heaton or General Heaton's deputy.
Dr. Berkeley, this is Crown. We're working as fast as possible trying to get the call through for you. He is at Walter Reed. We're unable to locate. We're still searching. Over.
The most urgent matter was removing the casket from the plane and transporting it to Bethesda Naval Hospital. Air Force One reached Jerry Benn, code name Duplex.
Duplex is on the line. Go ahead. Duplex, this is Duplex. Arrangements have been made for a helicopter for the Bethesda Naval Medical Center. Over.
Duplex is on. This is Dr. Berkeley. What arrangements have been made in regards to the reception of the President?
Everyone aboard Air Force One, with the exception of the body, will be choppered into the south ground. The body will be choppered to the Naval Medical Center at Bethesda. Over.
Body is in a casket, you know, and it will have to be taken by ambulance and not by chopper.
All right, I'll tell Captain Shepard that.
As Air Force One approached Washington, other small but necessary decisions were made. Major General Chester Clifton, code name Watchman, spoke to General Heaton.
This is General Clifton. Want a helicopter for Bethesda Medical Center. We do want a ambulance and a ground return from Andrews to Walter Reed. And we want the regular post-mortem that has to be done by law under guard performed at Walter Reed. Is that clear? Over.
That is clear, General Clifton.
Watchman then contacted Duplex with further specifications.
Duplex, this is Watchman, over.
Go ahead, Watchman, this is Duplex, over.
Now, some other instructions. Listen carefully. We need a ramp, a normal ramp was up at the front of the aircraft on the right-hand side, just behind the pilot's cabin in the galley. We are going to take the First Lady off by that route. Over, do you understand?
I receive affirmative.
Americans watched Air Force One touch down at Andrews at 5:58 in the afternoon.
The ramp is now moving up close to the back door of the presidential plane. And now we can see what we believe to be a coffin containing the body of President Kennedy being moved from Air Force One onto a special enclosed ramp, a mobile ramp, which was drawn up to the back door. Yes, we can make out the casket now.
For the first time, things seemed to be moving according to plan. The new president was in Washington. The rest of the cabinet would be in the Capitol by midnight. The government was in place. But for the next 3 days, Americans would share a mass of sounds and images that would remain with them for the rest of their lives. Today, they still seem as real as they did on that weekend 4 decades ago. For NPR News, this is Walter Cronkite.
Our story was produced by John McDonough for the 40th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's death. Walter Cronkite died in 2009. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.